Welcome back to the Bob Davis Podcasts. In podcast 513, some advice for podcasters. So I talk a lot about hydration and dehydration, and depending on what kind of exercise you're doing, hydration can make a huge difference in what you do and how you do it. So I know a lot of guys that play hockey, even though they're older, they still get out there and play. They play in older, you know, leagues. There are people that do cycling of different kinds, yoga, a lot of people doing CrossFit. If you're doing any of these things, I'm going to tell you about Hydrus, H-Y-D-R-U-S. Hydrus will transform what you do, because even if you drink a lot of water before you work out or practice, you're going to find that Hydrus makes a huge difference, because you know, you can drink a half a gallon of water before practice, let's say, or before working out, and you won't get fully hydrated until 25-30 minutes. Whereas with Hydrus, it uses a new technology to deliver these critical electrolytes to your muscles and hydrate you really fast, like fast, and without the sugar that is normally found in traditional sports drinks. So it doesn't matter if you cycle, CrossFit, lift, or do competitive sports. I just had an experience just this last week, as the storm rages, with doing yoga and doing Hydrus, and you don't flag halfway through the practice because you're fully hydrated. So it's a great thing. Hydrus helps me take it to the edge where you grow and you get stronger and you're able to actually do what you're doing. In my case, it's yoga. In other cases, it might be CrossFit or whatever, but you can work deeper into what you're doing and get better. And that is, of course, what it's all about. So join the performance hydration revolution. Visit HydrusPerformance.com. That's H-Y-D-R-U-S, HydrusPerformance.com. Plenty of content there that explains what Hydrus is and how it works. HydrusPerformance.com. That's HydrusPerformance.com. So let me set the stage for you. The plan was a rare daytime podcast. Most of the time when I do podcasts, I do them in the middle of the night. And I thought, I'll do a rare daytime podcast and I'll pull everything out and put it out on the deck. And that'll be really fun and exciting to do that. Well, I think we're going to have a storm. So I am in the living room and I've opened up all the windows and the screen door. So hopefully when the storm comes, if it comes, we'll be able to hear it. But it's been raining all morning and there was a break there where it was sunny. And so I was like, oh, I'll just come out here on the deck, even though it's damp. But no. That's not going to happen. So we're in the living room. You can hear, you know, some of the appliances running and living room kinds of sounds. And no, I don't have plastic on the furniture. You know, I don't have that kind of a thing. It's just my old furniture here in the living room at the broadcast bunker. The other reason I'm up here and wanted to be outside is when I do podcasts during the day, you know, we've got planes landing and everything, so it's too loud down there anyway to do a podcast in the studio. So hopefully it will storm. It's been weird and thundering, and then it goes away, and then it comes back, so maybe we'll have a huge storm while I'm doing this podcast. So a couple of big announcements, and I use big in quotes. I am adding an email list feature to the BobDavisPodcast.com. I'm going to do a newsletter. I'm going to call it the Bob Line, although the thing on the page does not say that, because in the interest of just not having you have to think, we just call it the newsletter because everybody knows what that means on the page. But when I actually do a newsletter, you will receive this thing called the Bob Line. So here's what you do. Go to the BobDavisPodcast.com, scroll down past mobile podcast command and all the buttons for donating and subscribing to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and TuneIn and all that stuff. And you're going to see a window for signing up for this newsletter. And we kept it simple so that, you know, it would be easy for you to figure that out. You put your email address in there. There's some thunder. And your name, and you'll be signed up. And I already tested it, so I know it works. This thing is going to be called the Bob Line. What is the history of the Bob Line? The Bob Line is kind of the father of this whole, you know, track of my life in the last 20 years. Because way back when, and this would have been in the late 90s, when I started to sort of transition out of music radio and into something else. I started working with my friend Randy Lane, who's a radio consultant, and I decided I was going to do a show prep service for morning shows, since we, you know, did morning shows, and I was just sort of I thought it would be a good thing to do. So I started doing a morning show prep service where I would stay up all night and scan the news headlines, given the vagaries of 56K dial-up internet at the time. And I wrote these little missives, and I remember it was the headlines were in red and the links were in blue, and I had to FTP it to All Access and send it out on an email list to all of our clients at like 4 o'clock in the morning, so that morning shows could get a hold of this. And a lot of people really liked the Bob line. A lot of radio guys thought it was great because it made it easy for them. They didn't have to do their show prep. Oddly enough, the Blaze email thing looks very much like the Bob line. Well, it's not going to look like that. It's going to be a whole different thing. It's going to be laid out like a magazine, but I will probably put one out probably sometime at the end of June or the beginning of July. So you're not going to get an email from me right away. But once we get going, I hope to be sending subscribers a special newsletter only for subscribers. And eventually it'll have special offers and opportunities only for us, those of us who are part of the Bob Line thing and subscribers to the Bob Line newsletter. It's going to give you my perspective, perhaps stuff I can't get into the podcast, perhaps stuff that I can, things that I would want to do with subscribers. So that's the first big announcement. The second part of the big announcement is I'm going to be filling in for Mitch Berg's show, the Northern Alliance show on 1280 this weekend, Father's Day weekend, Saturday, June 17th. And I guess at various times this summer, since Mitch has to take some time off. And I'm doing it to promote the podcasts and the radio show and the newsletter and the syndicated show, the BobDavisPodcast.com radio show. And I would do this for any affiliate, which we'll eventually be adding, and I'll tell you more about that when we get down the line. I'm not going to be going back to doing a daily radio show or, you know, doing a weekend show other than a syndicated show. So I said I would do advice for podcasters in this podcast, which I never do, by the way. And I'm going to tell you why I never do that here in a second. Because I was trolling through Facebook the other day, and I came across a post from somebody about this big podcaster convention in Chicago sometime soon. And I'm sure it costs $400 or $500. You got to go to this thing, and it's a bunch of panels. And I was like, oh, what's this? And I find out it's a bunch of radio people, and what they're going to do is they're going to have these panels, and they're going to give advice to podcasters. And of the many, you know, wonderful attributes of this podcasters group meeting, which is being promoted as the largest gathering of podcasters in history, many things will go on, including a critique session with professional broadcasters and some public radio guy who has a successful podcast to tell you what you need to do to make your podcast better. And this triggered a lot of stuff for me, not the least of which was a guy that I know, a good friend of mine, that famously said, laughed at me when I said way back in 2003, when I was working at KSTP, I said, we need to start doing these podcasts. This is really cool. We need to start putting podcasts up. And they laughed at me and called me the podcaster. And now, of course, that company purchased a big interest in Podcast One. And I'll tell you why that is happening in a second. And he said, he put on the Facebook, I'll see you there. You know, like he's the big podcast authority. And he poo-pooed the whole idea when Hubbard could have gotten into that way early. They poo-pooed it. It was, oh, podcasting. Are you crazy? And I just think that's funny. But it triggered some things about this and about this thing that we call podcasting. So if you're a podcaster, listen up. And I want to preface this by saying it's okay for people to want to help, and it's okay for people to do whatever they want to do. It's a free country. If they want to do a meeting of podcasters, good for them. But if you're a podcaster, I'm going to give you some, I think, really good advice, which I never do. Okay, and I'm not going to tell you how to get your podcast loaded on this. I'm not going to tell you what kind of microphone to use. I'm not going to tell you what you're supposed to say at the beginning of the podcast in it or any of that crap. But we'll start with this. According to Edison Research, something like 21 to 25% of the public now listens to podcasts. I think it is much higher than that, because the only way to assess how much of the public actually listens to podcasts is to ask them a series of questions or to aggregate in some way, shape, or form all of the analytic data that's available with different analytical applications and in different locations, etc. So it's probably a very low estimate, and this is why. First of all, each podcaster already has a sense of how many feeds they're serving up, depending on what kind of analytic they use, which is a better metric than just standard market research. That's the first thing. Second thing is there's no meters to know how much of your podcast people listen to. But who cares? Because they listen to half of it or listen to 10 minutes of it and throw it away. It doesn't matter. They took the feed. I mean, I don't think that... I mean, and there's a lot of videos on YouTube, for example, which, you know, are 15, 20, 30 minutes long. And I don't know that everyone watches all of them, but they count. You know, when you look and see the number of views, 64,000 views or whatever, okay, you know, they clicked on it, they watched a part of it, and that's all you can expect. So we already have an idea of how many people are using our podcast, depending on what kind of analytics we're using. I use two or three different systems to determine, you know, the number of feeds. And it's funny because there's a whole bunch of people out there that are, you know, trying to snark out on, you know, well, you know, a feed could be, you know, if you go past two cell towers, it counts as two feeds. I don't know if that's true, and who cares? Again, there are no meters, and we don't want meters, by the way, to tell people how much of the podcast people are listening to, because it doesn't matter. What matters is they took the feed, they clicked on your page, they listened to part of your podcasts, and that's the whole point. As I said, they can listen to it, turn it off, listen later, whatever they want to do. Plus, if people listen to two or three more podcasts in any given location, so if you listen to Louder with Crowder and you listen to the Bob Davis podcasts and you listen to, three or four other, a comedian and some freaky podcast about, street repair or something, then that's could be as much as 4 or 5 hours of listening. So, you know, if you have a long commute, great. But that's a lot of time away from the radio. And that's the whole point of this little missive here about what people listen to and when they listen to it and feeds and so forth. You know, the quality of analytics is a long conversation. And, you know, you can have that conversation with yourself anytime you want to, because I do all the time. The point here is you get to listen to whatever you want, whenever you want it. And this is killing radio, which is why suddenly radio is interested in podcasting. The other problem in podcasting is monetizing, and this involves sales. And this is another reason radio people are interested in podcasting, because suddenly they're the experts on how to sell, and they know how to monetize. We know how to do all this, and this is why we can really help these podcasters, because we're radio people, and we know how to do all this stuff. Because most podcasters don't know how to sell, they don't know how to find sponsors, they don't know how to do ads, and they don't, you know, maybe they have a podcast and they want somebody else to do that because it's too hard. And, you know, if you can find a syndicator, if you can find somebody that can do that for you, great. I'm going to talk about entrepreneurial creativity here in a second, because I'm not so sure that the way to do sales and to monetize podcasts is the way, you know, radio people have been selling radio over the last 30 years. And I'm not sure the way to get into digital is the way the broadcast radio industry has got. We're back. We're into digital. You know, we're going to have this app, and it's going to include live programming from all of these radio stations. And it's going to be great. So I'm not so sure that's how we get into digital. I'm not sure that's the right way to get into digital. I'm going to talk about that in a little bit. So I've been in business selling podcasting since 2009 and in earnest since 2013. And every single podcast I've done since 2013, which is something like 450 podcasts, has had a paid sponsor or more than one, and sometimes three, and sometimes four. And I've been able to retain clients because podcast advertising works. It is very cost effective if you get in and stay in. So this is a message to advertisers. If you have a favorite podcaster and you're going to sponsor that podcaster, then make a commitment to sponsor that podcaster for 2 or 3 years, and you will see really good results from it. And sometimes you'll see the results immediately, and sometimes it will take some time for you to see the results. So digital media, podcasting, YouTube, SoundCloud, is very subtle because it is worldwide. And somebody might have a very small audience around town, but they might have a very large audience when it's all added up aggregately. You never know who's going to hear what you're doing. And I think that's the key thing. It is completely listener-driven. Now, this is important. And there really are no rules. There are no rules about how to sell it. There are no rules about how to do it. So when I saw this thing about the Podcasters Convention in Chicago, I choked on my breakfast, which I'm usually eating at around 2 p.m. local time. And I'll tell you why in a second. You know, that's another benefit of being in business for yourself and doing digital media. You get to work when you feel like it. You don't have to work when somebody tells you that you have to work. Well, it doesn't matter what kind of company you have, small or large. If you work for a company, usually this is the time of the year when companies like to get people together for these team-building exercises. Sometimes they have consultants come in and they do exercises that are designed to get everybody working creatively together. And it doesn't matter whether it's at some location, you know, some conference center, or in some hotel conference room someplace, or if you're doing something really physical like cliff, whatever they call it, cliff diving or rappelling or whatever it is. Especially for the stuff that's really physical. A lot of times if you work with a company that's got a lot of athletes, you know, they think it's great, but if you're not that person, it's really, really scary and difficult and it doesn't go over well. So if you're the person that suggests new team building exercises, I'm going to give you a suggestion. I think it's a good idea because I think it really brings out creativity. You don't have to be an artist. You don't have to be creative. It's just fun. It's a fun new way to bond with employees, and work your creative juices into the team, and everybody comes away feeling great. At Brush Studio in the West End in St. Louis Park, where there's plenty of parking, I always mention that. Brush Studio events are held in a relaxed and social atmosphere. What happens is an artist guides your people through a featured painting step by step. But it's not about painting. You don't have to have an experience. People are amazed at what they're able to do. It is not paint by numbers, by the way. It is an artist who teaches and guides and shows people how to paint this painting. And they come away with stuff they can hang on their walls. They're amazed. If you visit the Brush Studio website at brushstudio.net, you'll see videos and it shows what it's like. They are event planning ninjas. It's going to be a great time and a great opportunity for all the people on your team to bond, and they don't have to walk across coals. It's great because it's designed for left brain people to bring out the right brain, which means ideas for your team, and it is much better than spending all day in a conference room or rappelling down a cliff. They have room for 55 people, plus catering from Crave in the West End. They have 22 brands of beer available there. They have 22 brands of beer available there, an extensive wine collection at Brush Studio. If you want to know more, like I said, check out the brushstudio.net banner at the top of the Bob Davis podcast page, or visit them at brushstudio.net, not .com. I said .com in an earlier ad. Sorry, you guys. brushstudio.net, or you can reach out to them directly, 952-236-1700. They will explain it to you. They're great people. 952-236-1700, Brush Studio. So I was saying that I was choking on my breakfast. And let me just say this. If you're a podcaster, the last thing you need is advice from a radio person. Let me repeat that. If you're a podcaster, the last thing you need is advice from a radio person, especially from radio people. In fact, you should avoid advice from radio people like the plague. And I say this as a podcaster who has been doing this since 2009, and as a person who has been a fan and interested in podcasts since 2003, and as a person who has done 500 podcasts, not as a radio person. Do I say this because I don't like radio people? No, I love radio people. I am a radio person, and I will always be a radio person, but I'm also a podcaster. And if you're a podcaster, my advice to you is to do whatever the hell that you want to do. If you want a podcast, where you travel the nation and record yourself peeing at every truck stop, you know, do it. If you want a podcast, actually, that's a good idea. Do it. If you want a podcast where you talk only about raising rhododendrons, do it. If you have a crappy voice and you know a lot about soccer and how to teach kids soccer, do it anyway. If you are 17 years old and you and your friends from down the block think that you're really funny and hilarious and you want to do a comedy podcast, do it. If you only have your PC microphone, who cares? Do it anyway. If you're afraid it's not going to sound good, it doesn't matter. Just do it. And there are plenty of examples of that on YouTube. There are terrible YouTube people who have plenty of subscribers, and there are great YouTube people who have no subscribers. So there are no rules. And I think this is the biggest problem with all of this, because radio people are trapped in a prison, and it's a prison called professional. And I guess there's a history to this, and I guess I'll give you some of it. Radio originally, as we all know, the golden age of radio was a place where you heard radio dramas that were live, performances that were live, live shows from the great jazz age at the big hotels in Chicago, New York, and so forth. And then they had newsmen and news departments, and it was like broadcast television in the golden age of broadcast television. Now, television killed all that in radio because television was such a different medium, and people immediately moved after the war to television because they could do all this stuff in television, and television was terrible. The people in radio thought television was terrible. It looked terrible. It was amateurish. It was in black and white. It was like, oh my God, this is terrible. And a lot of radio people couldn't make the shift from radio to television because they had a face made for radio, or it just, what they were doing didn't translate. And it took a long time for television to figure out how to do drama and how to do news and how to find people that made it work, and it wasn't radio. They had to figure out that they didn't have to use the things that they used in radio to make things work. They did what they did in television. And it took 20 years for television to really come into its own. So, the mid-70s is really, in my view, the golden age of television, because it took that long for TV to develop. Now, at the same time, radio reemerged because of a thing called spot sales. A lot of people think, oh, it was rock and roll that brought radio back. No, it was spot sales, because what they figured out was that they could, and it was really the cartridge machine, you know, the 8-track machine, the cartridge tape machine, where they took reel-to-reel tape. Before this, the way that you did things in radio was you had these things called acetate recordings, and every radio station had a recording device that you made a platter, and then you put that on a turntable and you played it on the air through the turntable. And the cartridge tape machine revolutionized radio because it enabled radio stations to put things on cartridge tape and just push the cartridge tape into the cartridge machine and hit play, and it played the cart, and the cart all the way, you know, the tape went all the way around to the beginning on a loop, and it stopped at the beginning, and it was queued up to be used again later. And eventually radio stations started putting music on those carts and everything else. But the cart machine is the thing that actually revolutionized radio, because what it did was it enabled radio owners to start looking at radio as a revenue producing device using this thing called spot sales. Instead of doing live endorsements, and instead of doing shows where we sell out whole hours and half hours, all we have to do is sell 30 and 60 second increments. And so what we'll do is we'll sell out 30 and 60 second increments, and then we will, you know, do what we call spot breaks, where we stop down and we play four or five of these, and then we go back to programming. So that revolutionized radio in the late 50s, early 60s, when the first cart machines came out. And that's the thing that started it. And then, of course, you know, the actual, 45 RPM record and the 33 RPM record revolutionized radio with music. So radio reemerged as a business with spot sales and formatting. And the explanation to that, without going into too much detail, is that you had music stations, and you had news stations, and you had different iterations of types of radio stations. WGN and WCCO in Minneapolis, WGN in Chicago, were something that we called entertainment information radio stations, or middle of the road radio stations. They played Edie Gourmet and jazz artists, and they did news, and they had personalities, and they were usually the number one station in the market wherever they were. And they were usually the station that had transitioned from being the station, you know, the big NBC Blue or NBC Red radio station or CBS radio station in the market where they were. They had transitioned into being this, you know, sort of big old line radio station, and mom and dad listened to that radio station. And then from there, you got adult contemporary radio stations, and you got something called rock radio stations, which were top 40 radio stations, which emerged from the swamp of the early days of rock and roll. A lot of people don't know this, but in the early days of rock and roll, the rock and roll stations, or the race stations, which were essentially rhythm and blues stations, were the low-powered radio stations in town. So they were at 1440 and 1280 and 1330 and 1590, and it was hard to get them, and there was no FM, and they were the only ones that played that stuff because nobody knew what to do with it anyway, and none of those big radio stations were going to do stuff like put, you know, these black performers on the air. So rock and roll music was considered really risky, and so they didn't play it. So all the rock stations were really low power, messed up, old, crappy AM radio stations that nobody listened to anymore. And then when rock music became big around 1960, 1961, 62, it started to move to the big 50,000 watt clear channel radio stations. Not Clear Channel the company, but 50,000 watt clear channel radio stations like WLS and WABC, and stations that reached, you know, from Chicago to the entire North American continent, or from New York City all the way down the beaches to Philadelphia, or all the way up to New Hampshire. That's WABC. So that was a revolution. And I could go on talking about radio history, but I want the point here I'm making about radio is that at that time, what started to happen was we developed a paradigm approach to radio, a formatic approach to radio. You played the jingle here. You talked here. You played the top record every time this light goes on in the control room. You only played 30 or 40 top records because we learned if we rotated records tightly, we would get more listeners, because nobody doesn't like their favorite song, and little kids were listening, and teenagers were listening, and young adults were listening. And they wanted to hear their favorite song. They wanted to hear the new Beatles song. And they wanted to hear it every 15 minutes because the audience flipped over and changed. And as ratings progressed, radio programmers got more and more technical in terms of getting ratings. The first real technician to come along, one of them was named John Rook. And there are many, many others. Dwight Case, John Rook, plenty of other programmers. Bob Henneberry. And then what came along was someone called Bill Drake, who had a very specific style and approach. And this was the development of stations like KHJ and KFRC. Drake worked for RKO General, which owned 7 AMs and 7 FMs all over the country. And again, that's another little area of interest. And at the same time, you know, the record industry was growing and changing. And if you want to find out about that, you kind of can watch the show Vinyl on HBO, which kind of, or Showtime or whatever it is, that kind of gives you a little history of the record business. It's a little different from the history of radio. But I think the main point here is that after Drake, radio began to develop this approach, this paradigm approach. We have to do it this way, kind of like screenwriting. The first 30 minutes, you set it up. The second 30 minutes is the story. The third 30 minutes, you peak the plot and you wrap up loose ends. In television, you have a formula for writing a television show. So these are paradigms that have developed over the years, and it's a very formulaic approach. In television and movie making, you can usually break the mold and start over because that's kind of how those mediums work. None of the people in radio understand that they aren't original thinkers. What they are is human copy machines. They are human Xerox machines. This is what they spend their time doing. They find out what somebody else is doing, and then they copy that, and they turn that into a paradigm, and then they go around and they tell people, this is the way you have to do this. And that is generally all those people know. Now, there are truly original and creative thinkers in the radio business. I don't think there's many left, if any. Most of them have moved on to other things. It's funny because some of the best jocks that I knew back in the day that I really admired, became lawyers. they went to law school and they got out of radio, or they went into digital, or they went into something else. So they're no longer in the radio business. I think the people that are left, they're far and few between truly creative entrepreneurial thinkers. And radio companies are desperate to get into podcasting and digital. Unfortunately, in general, broadcasters suck at digital and podcasting, and they will ruin it. And I don't mean that to be personally bitter or angry. I just think it's a mindset that will ruin it. And the reason is they think they know how to fix everything, because they think that the way that they do things is the way that things should be done. And that fixing it involves telling you what you should do that everyone else is doing. You should do it this way. Here's this guy that does this podcast, and he really knows what he's talking about. He's going to tell you how to do it. And I think it's great that they want to help. You know, it's a free country. They can help, and they can charge people whatever people are stupid enough to pay to quote unquote help podcasters get better, but they aren't going to help you get better. And I'll give you an example. One of my clients, Hydrus, I've been helping them buy other podcasts, you know, advertising in other podcasts. And Hydrus is doing a lot of stuff with CrossFit. You know, CrossFit athletes love Hydrus. This isn't a commercial for Hydrus, by the way. I already did that. Anyway, you know, they love CrossFit. And one of the things we learned, and I hate to say it that way because that's what radio people always say, is... So a lot of these CrossFit podcasts are terrible. I mean, you know, from a radio perspective, they're terrible podcasts. The guys, they're recorded terribly. The guys don't know what they're doing. But here's the thing about CrossFit podcasts. What they're doing is they're one of the guys that Hydrus uses that's been very effective for Hydrus, sells a lot of Hydrus, is a cop who also does a podcast about CrossFit. And he's also a CrossFit nut. And these guys know a lot about CrossFit. So what they're doing is imparting information about CrossFit that CrossFit freaks can't get anyplace else. So this CrossFit spot this guy does, you know, I do my podcast and they sell some Hydrus, but this guy kicks my ass. Why? Because he's doing a terrible podcast, let's just say. It's probably better than that, but let's just say it's a terrible podcast. But the information that he's doing, the content that he's doing, is critical for people that want to hear it. Now, he has about 1,200 feeds for a podcast that he does once a week, maybe. And that's not really a lot of feeds. It's not a terrible amount of feeds, but every one of those 1,200 people bought Hydrus. See how this works? There's Travel Podcasts, the same kind of thing, where they don't have that many listeners, and they may not be great podcasters, but the information that they're imparting about what they're doing is critical to the people that are listening, and they will find that podcast, and they will listen to it, and they will listen to what those people tell them to do, and they will do it, because that's how it works, and it's fascinating that way. What's the problem in radio? Well, I've said it before. They want compelling programming, but when they get somebody who is potentially compelling, they end up getting rid of them, because the true creativity actually terrifies these paradigm broadcasters, because they can't understand, because they have a certain paradigm for the way to think and how they think things should sound, and when they don't sound that way, they reject it. And they reject it from a management perspective. They reject it in very nasty, personally damaging ways. The fact is, if you're doing a podcast, the stuff that you're doing, whatever it is, takes a lot of trial and error. The things that my podcasts are different from what they were like when I started. They're going to be different than what they're like today down the line, because I've done so many of them and I've learned how I want to do them. Now, you may not want to do them that way. That's your business. And now you've got all these people all over the place telling you what you have to do and how you have to do it. One of the people that I syndicate my podcasts through told me that I have to collapse all my feeds into their podcasts. And I was like, I'm not doing that. And they went crazy. They called me, they bothered me, they emailed me, they demanded that I do it. And I just was like, you know what? I'm not doing that. I refuse to do that because I want a lot of different sources for my feeds. I don't want to collapse my feed into one source for a lot of different reasons. It's one of the reasons I have my own website, and I refuse to listen to that, partially because I will not ever be under the control of any one particular source for what I do creatively ever again, whether it is writing, whether it is screenwriting, whether it is doing podcasts. I don't care. I will never allow someone to have complete control over what I do again, because that's none other thing. Once they have control of what you're doing, they will ruin you. And there's a lot of reasons for that. Have nothing to do with radio. So if we've learned anything from digital, we have learned that you can do anything you want, no matter how far out, you can find an audience for it. Believe me, it doesn't matter. Now, if you're truly an entrepreneur, I told you I was going to talk about that. You know, you're probably willing to collaborate. You're probably looking for collaborative experience, and you're probably pretty open-minded, and you're like, well, hey, I'm going to go and listen to him, and that's fine. But you got to be really careful that you don't allow your mind creatively to be infected by people who are really trapped in a prison of paradigm-type thinking. I am not a collaborator. I don't like collaborating with people. I tend to try to figure out what I want to do, because I think true creativity comes from deep down inside, and I don't think I've even scratched the surface of what I can do. And I think radio is very damaging for that, because what it does is radio is very top down. And, you know, as I said, this is the way we do things. You know, this is how we've always done it, and you're going to do it this way because this is how we do it here, period. And if you don't do it that way, then, you know, we don't like you anymore. And instead of just getting rid of you, we're just going to make your life miserable. We're going to try to manipulate you. And if anybody listening in radio who's a talent knows exactly what I'm talking about. And, you know, in their defense, the reason for that is because of the peculiar nature of mass media. You know, it's a mass medium, and there's a way to do it, and, you know, it's a formulaic approach, and that's how things need to get done, and I understand that, but that's not what podcasting is. Now, I hail originally from music radio. When I was a kid, I listened to the radio, and I listened to music on the radio, and I got interested in radio because I was interested in music, and I was interested in the whole idea of radio, partially because my mom and my grandpa and my dad gave me a tape recorder when I was a little kid, and I started playing with it. But I got into talk radio because it was an opportunity to create free of having to play songs and do breaks and so forth. And because honestly, I wanted to go back on the radio, and I didn't know anything about talk radio. I didn't even listen to talk radio. I didn't even like talk radio. But I will tell you, to become good at talk radio takes an awful lot of work. And to become good at podcasting takes an awful lot of work at podcasting. And the one thing that I've learned is rules were made to be broken. And I will divert quickly, because this is going to end up being a longer podcast, but I'll do it quickly. I will divert because I watch a lot of these documentaries about musical artists on Netflix. You know, and after I've watched everything that you can watch on Netflix, note that I'm talking about Netflix and not broadcast television, because they wouldn't put any of these documentaries on broadcast television. You know, I watched the Janis Joplin documentary, which is awesome. And I've watched, you know, the Tom Petty stuff. And I watched the one about the Eagles. A lot of people have watched that documentary about the Eagles. And Glenn Frey was talking about when they first got started, they were not very good musicians, and they went out to L.A., and they made an effort to start learning how to do, how to write songs and how to play. And he started talking about how they kind of got to the point where they learned how to write songs. And he said, listen to that thunder, I learned a lot from Jackson Browne about how to write songs, because I lived upstairs from Jackson Browne, and he would just bang away on the piano all day until he figured out how to write a song. And it took them, you know, I mean, they had 3 or 4 albums before they really figured out how to write a really good song. So it's an interesting perspective from someone who I considered to be really amazing, Glenn Frey, who just said, hey, I didn't know how to write a song. And most of those people don't. So if you're a podcaster and you say, I don't know how to be a podcaster, it doesn't matter. You know, do what you think that you need to do, and do what is calling out to you. If you want to sit on the toilet and do a podcast, great. If you want to sit in your front yard and do a podcast, if you want to sit in your car and do a podcast, you know, that's fine. Whatever works for you. And if you're an entrepreneur in terms of figuring out how to make money from doing this, you know, I would say you might be the guy that figures it out, but you're not going to figure it out if you go and you listen to radio people tell you how to sell podcasts, because they're going to tell you you can't do that. They're going to tell you you're not supposed to do it that way. They're going to tell you we never did it that way and here's why and blah, blah, blah. And all that is doing is just infecting you, because you might have an idea that's stupid that actually turns out to be the way that all of us make more money. So good for you. And because that, why? Because that's what happens in an entrenched industry that is actually contracting. Radio is contracting as a business. And as soon as a business starts contracting, it starts trying to protect what it is and what it has been in an increasingly aggressive way, because the world for that industry is getting increasingly competitive. And the people that are in radio today that are acting this way, and they do it without knowing it, they won't be the people that save radio, and they won't be the people that save television. It will be people who have no idea what they're doing that save it, because nobody knew what they were doing when radio got started. Nobody knew what they were doing when rock and roll got started. Nobody knew what they were doing when television and movies got started. And here's a couple of other things for people who are listening. Radio does not suck because of consolidation. Radio does not suck because of debt. Radio sucks because people won't let people be creative, and they won't let people do what they do because they're so tied to this minute-by-minute metering. And don't even get me started about the vagaries of the rating services. And the entire industry has a top-down management structure, which is designed to make all the decisions at the top. And the people at the bottom are really just grocery clerks. And I've said it before, and it's harsh, but I'm going to say it again. The local Starbucks barista has more autonomy at their store than your local radio station general manager and the program directors in general. It's not because they're bad people. Some of them are great people. But it's because of the way radio thinks. It's a very top-down business, and it's not going to change. I don't care what they say. Well, we've changed that. We're not like that. And yes, you are, because that's how it is. And it will never change. You know, grocery store managers, you know, basically run the grocery store. They don't decide what's in there. The grocery store clerk puts things on the shelves and takes things off the shelves. That's what radio general managers do. So if you're a podcaster, forget about radio people. The last thing that you want is a critique of your work. I won't critique what people do in podcasting. I won't tell them how to do it. I won't tell them how to get their podcast syndicated. I won't tell them what kind of microphone to use. I won't tell them when to do it. I won't tell them the structure, because I don't know anything about it. I don't know what I'm doing. And I freely admit it, and I had to figure this stuff out by myself. One of my good friends, Kyle Sheely, and I've talked about this before, is my producer at KSTP, said, you know, I was furious when I got fired from KSTP, and I was trying to do podcasting. I didn't know what I was doing, and, you know, I was calling him up and yelling at him, and he just laughed at me. And he goes, Bob, if I can put a wrestling podcast up, you can figure this out. And I hung up on him, and I went down to the Apple store, and I spent like the next 5 days at the Apple store. And yes, I did. I figured it out. I figured it out because Kyle made me. He didn't tell me how to do it. So if you're a podcaster, forget about all that. Here's what you do. Do whatever you want in spades. Don't listen to somebody who says, this is what you need to do. Because how do they know what to do? We don't know what to do. This digital media thing is not a mass media. It is only in its infancy. You know, things like Instagram and Facebook and Twitter and everything else, you're going to forget all about this in 10, 15 years. They're going to be gone, and something will be in its place. This is all brand new, and there are no rules. And anyone who tells you their rules, you know, I don't think they know what they're talking about. You know, I'll give you a couple examples. I did give you some examples from filmmaking. Well, here's a great example from filmmaking. So one of the things I like to do is watch those director tracks on movies where the directors talk about what they're doing, because I think it's fascinating, because movies are amazing, because it takes so many people to make a movie. And directors, you know, have a certain approach to how they do things, and every one of them has a different approach. You know, all these rules about how you're supposed to direct and blah, 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 blah. Well, if you don't know anything about The Godfather, we're talking about the very first Godfather, which was a masterpiece. Francis Ford Coppola is, you know, truly a masterpiece, as far as I'm concerned, movie. When he made The Godfather, Paramount Studios, which was very much a top-down controlled company, thought The Godfather should be one of these miniseries type things, which was a generational movie. And as Coppola put it, they wanted hippies in it at the end. And what he did was he said, okay, yeah, sure. And he went out and started to make his own movie. And at every turn, he avoided the managers and the accountants from Paramount and tricked them. One of the things that he would do is they would come in, and he tells about how he had to fire everyone because he knew that the accounts were coming in and they were going to fire everybody. So he fired everyone first, and then he rehired them the next day after they left. Another thing is, people don't know this, but George Lucas was editing that movie, and I think shooting and editing or something like that, that movie. And the famous scene in the hospital, Coppola wanted to shoot it the way you see it, where the halls are empty and it builds the suspense for this attempted murder of the Godfather in the movie. And Paramount said, no, you can't do that because you don't have enough money. So Coppola was fit to be tied because he was like, well, I have to shoot it this way, so I'm just going to do it, because they wouldn't buy more film. And Lucas said, don't worry, what we'll do is we'll just let it roll when the halls are empty, and then I'll cut it in later. So that's how those whole halls were set up. They would just let the tape roll after a take, and for the required time, and then Lucas pieced that all together when he edited the movie. And I think that's fascinating, because Coppola did all that in spite of the really intelligent guys who knew how to do everything, because the way movies were made up to that point, 1970, 1969, was they were all epic Westerns with, they wanted a soundtrack, and Coppola brought his father in to make the soundtrack because he didn't like what Paramount wanted to do. Why? Because he, along with Spielberg and a lot of these other people, Lucas, the people that made Star Wars, they thought it was a joke. Everybody said, this is a terrible movie, and it was huge. The Godfather was panned when it first came out, until people actually saw it and they said, oh my God, this is great. Everybody, Coppola left LA and slept on a friend's couch because he was so embarrassed that everyone hated the movie. And he got a call in San Francisco and somebody said, hey, you just won an Oscar. He didn't even know. So that's what I mean about creativity. You learn from these other people who were groundbreaking how to really be creative. This is not a fine art. There are times when artists on television, whatever, and in podcasting, rise to a fine art. And are we artists? I don't know. But, I don't know that great artists are created by studying art. I think that a lot of times they just have a gift. Sometimes it's an incredible gift, but I don't know that those people necessarily study art. Jim Morrison studied film, but he was a musical artist and really had, he hooked up with Mary Manzarek and started writing these crazy songs. I mean, he was at UCLA Film School and he made a film and everyone thought it was terrible. I mean, these are true stories about people. Janis Joplin went to San Francisco and started hanging out at just the right time in the place, and she could sing, but she didn't learn to sing until she cut Pearl. She wasn't really a great singer until then. And I think what happens is people in the record business, people in the radio business, people in the film business can get trapped in a time warp. I've been there. I've been trapped in that warp. And some people can't get out. You're lucky if you get fired because you're pushed out. These people think it's the 1970s or the 1980s or the early 90s. It's just like some of the political people that think that Ronald Reagan is going to come back at the next election. It's not going to happen because it's a different time with different needs and different things. So when it comes to podcasting, do what you feel. And by the way, doing something different in a podcast does not mean that you're going to suddenly get more listeners. I thought of this before I did the podcast today. The best example I could think of is, let's just say you do a podcast about wallpaper. You're an interior decorator and you're just a wallpaper, savant. You've just got this wallpaper thing down pat. And maybe you give tips like, well, if you put vinegar on the wallpaper before you put up, it does this. And if you let it sit in the paste for 5 days, it does this. And I don't know, I'm making this up. I don't know anything about wallpaper. But you're this woman who does, this incredible wallpaper stuff. And you've got a pot. You decide you're going to do a podcast. So you start doing a podcast in your basement. you know, and the kids are crying, and the, you know, the husband is coming home, and, you know, but you do this terrible podcast about wallpaper, and you suddenly get, you know, 400 or 500 people listening, and you've got your subscribers, because they're like, well, this woman really knows about wallpaper. I love her stuff. And you do your thing, and you're doing what you do, and you're a wallpaper person, and you're this expert on wallpaper, and you do a podcast once a month regularly, and you put your wallpaper podcast up, and people that listen to you love it. And then one day you get an email from somebody, and it's like, this is Susan, blah, 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 blah. I work for Leo DiCaprio, and Leo found your podcast, and he really thinks it's awesome, and he wants you to come out to his house in Los Angeles and wallpaper his bathroom. I'm making this up, but this is the kind of thing that happens. And you're like, oh, come on, this is ridiculous. So you email back, you know, oh, my God, yeah, I'll do it. And so you vet this person. You find out, okay, it's for real. She actually works for Leo DiCaprio. They send you a plane ticket. You fly out to L.A. You bring your computer and your microphone, blah, 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 because you're super excited to meet Leo DiCaprio. You get there. Leo meets you. He loves you. You guys put up the wallpaper. It's fantastic. You take pictures. You post them on Instagram. You have dinner with Leo DiCaprio and his friends, and it's this amazing weekend. You do two or three of these podcasts out there with Leo DiCaprio asking you questions about wallpaper and whatever. And then you fly home and you come back and you open up your analytics and you've got 100,000 subscribers. Okay? You didn't do anything except do your podcast, and Leo DiCaprio heard it and said, come on out and wallpaper my bathroom. And now you're this chick that has 100,000 subscribers. That's digital media. And it can happen to anyone. And it can happen to the worst podcaster on the planet or the best. And it can happen to the person who diligently works at it day after day after day. And it can happen to the person that just, you know, sits down and does a podcast and just happens to some comedian or somebody who, you know, happens to be a contractor. Doesn't matter. That's what digital media does. You know, could that happen in radio? No, because you know what? Nobody cool listens to the radio anymore. I mean, it's fun to do, and that's why I still do it occasionally. But people don't listen to the radio anymore. They listen to podcasts. They watch Netflix. They use their phones as a tool to give them the information they need when they need it, and on demand. It's all about on demand. Audio on demand, television on demand, information on demand. And it's only going to increase. And what we have is an increasingly tribal culture where people run with tribes, but that doesn't mean they're always with that tribe. So maybe you're a Harley guy who also likes to wallpaper, you know, and you listen to this wallpaper podcast as well as all the Harley podcasts. Or maybe you're a CrossFit guy who does yoga a lot and you start listening to a yoga podcast. That's how this whole thing works. It's a complete opposite of how radio works. Radio doesn't work that way. It's a mass medium. It's I'm talking to 60,000 people, except most radio people aren't anymore. And most of you who are podcasting probably have more audience at any given time than the local radio station has. And I don't care whether you're a DJ. I mean, look at the stuff on SoundCloud. These DJs put their stuff on SoundCloud. They don't need record companies. You know, they become huge stars. They can make $300,000-$500,000 off their SoundCloud stuff. And I mean, what happens is people are like, I like this guy. I want him to play at our event. And they go out and they do 3 or 4 or 5 shows a night sometimes. And these guys can make great money building off of their SoundCloud and their blog and their Instagram and their stuff, doing what they love to do. Isn't that the promise of digital? It's supposed to be you have this opportunity to do what you love to do and make money doing it and feed your family and grow your business and enjoy yourself and not have to answer to anyone. That's the basis of this. Don't let people who are trapped in that kind of a world, you know, and that's why radio people, and that's why the industry is suddenly interested in podcasting, because suddenly the researchers say, oh my God, these people, everybody's listening to podcasting. So now suddenly all these podcasters are being told by radio people what they're supposed to do. Do whatever you want. Let your stuff find an audience. Love that audience and let your audience love you. Now, as far as monetizing is concerned, there's going to be people that will help you monetize, and that's a good thing. And if you can find sponsors that will support you, then all you have to do is go out and ask people, hey, can you support me? How much would you give me to support me? And you'll find that someone eventually will support you. And for those of you, and I'm going to reiterate, for those of you who are thinking about advertising and podcasting, you know, if you're one of these companies that spends thousands of dollars on value pack or ads in the local Sun newspapers, let's say the local neighborhood newspapers, or you spend all kinds of money on the radio, you're wasting your money. Because the thing with podcasting is, if you put a little bit of money into podcasting over the long term and you stay with it over the long term, you will start to get business and it will stay with you. Because there's a bond between podcasters and their listeners, and there's a bond between podcasters and the people that find their podcast about wallpaper or CrossFit. And they trust what that person is saying. So I wouldn't tell you how to do it. I wouldn't tell you how to monetize. I wouldn't tell you how to run the spots that you're going to do. I wouldn't tell you how to do the endorsements. You just can do what you think works or what actually works for your people. And if that's the way you do it, if that means you have to sing the spot, sing it. If that means you have to run a production spot, run a production spot. If that means that you have to, you know, I don't think that there should be any rules in this, because the last thing you want is people telling you, oh, no, this is how we do it in podcasting. Now, you sit down and listen, because this is, we're going to write some stuff on the board. And, you know, Jim Stevens over here from 14ZYQ and Phil from CBS Radio, these guys are really good, and they're going to tell you how to do this. Those guys don't know anything. They don't know anything. And even if they know something, they're probably not going to tell you, number one. And number two, even if they think they know something, if they really know something, they're going to know they don't know anything. Thanks again to Brush Studio in the West End in St. Louis Park, where there's plenty of parking, for sponsoring the Bob Davis Podcast. Once again, in terms of corporate events, if you're looking for a team-building exercise, Brush Studio is the place. Check them out online at brushstudio.net, or you can call them directly. They'll tell you all about it at 952-236-1700. That's 952-236-1700. I think it's great for corporate team-building events. And thanks again to Hydrus. I just practiced yoga last night, and it was amazing because I had my Hydrus, and sometimes I have these practices. I have these practices that blow my mind because I just don't get tired and I don't get sore and I can hit it again the very next day. The reason is Hydrus, H-Y-D-R-U-S. Check out HydrusPerformance.com. That's H-Y-D-R-U-S. HydrusPerformance.com explains the whole thing, and you'll see how it works. It's amazing. Really, it is. And there's no sugar, which is great. And I could go on and on, but I won't. Thanks again. HydrusPerformance.com. Thanks, you guys, for sponsoring the Bob Davis Podcasts. So pilots who are listening know what I'm talking about. You know, the most critical point of a flight is when they turn on final approach, usually. So that's why they talk about takeoffs and landings being difficult. And it is great to have a visual indicator of your angle of attack when you're turning on final approach. There's lots of pilots. Not all of them really understand why this is useful. It does save lives. The bottom line is Alpha Systems AOA is available. It saves lives. It's FAA approved. Click on the Alpha Systems banners for more information about Alpha's revolutionary angle of attack indicator at thebobdavispodcast.com. Takes you to their page. There's video and explanation of it, and they want to get it into your package as quickly as possible because it is, you know, it is a lifesaver. So check out Alpha Systems, and thanks you guys for sponsoring the Bob Davis Podcasts as the planes come in on their final approach over the house. Thanks to you for listening on Stitcher.com, iTunes, TuneIn, and BlogTalkRadio.com. Thanks for liking, sharing, favoriting, and following on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. I'm the Bob Davis Podcasts on Instagram and at Bob Davis Podcast on Twitter. Thanks for your donations. Also for mobile podcast command at thebobdavispodcast.com. Once again, best advice I can give you if you're interested in podcasting is just do it. Get it up there, do it, have fun, and see what happens. Thanks for listening to Podcast 513.
Take it slow, but it's not typical. In the bathroom, hide away.